This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who tucks Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Talamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Mike Penna and Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Mike Penna and jockey Christina McManigal welcoming you to our brand new show here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. It is Jock Talk, where every Tuesday from 6 to 7 Eastern, we'll take you inside the lives and careers of racing's elite athletes. And Christina, how about this daily double to kick things off with our first two shows? Last week, we had the opportunity to visit with Hall of Famer Mike Smith for the entire hour. And tonight, we get to welcome in another Hall of Famer.
Makes for a great show, and we're honored to have such successful jockeys here.
Royalty.
With us. Such royalty.
Royalty.
Is that the word you were looking for?
That's the word I was looking for, yes.
Of course, that voice you just heard is Hall of Famer Chris McCarron. He's going to be with us for the full hour here tonight, and boy, couldn't be happier to welcome him to the program. Chris, thanks for being here in studio with us.
Well, thank you very much, Mike, for having me, and Christina, it's a real treat, real pleasure for me to be sitting across this desk from you. Christina, if for those out there who don't know, graduated from our program here at the North American Racing Academy several years ago. She plied her trade incredibly well. She was a very successful race rider, mostly in Maryland. And I'm incredibly proud of her accomplishments. And unfortunately, do they know her story yet?
Very briefly. They don't know much of it.
Okay. Well, she's incredibly tough. She's got skin that is as thick as an elephant. And she's absolutely fearless, afraid of nothing whatsoever. Was hurt several times, didn't matter. She came back until an unfortunate little incident occurred that forced her to retire. But she is, I'll repeat myself, I'm just incredibly proud.
Well, thank you, Chris. And I have to thank you very much, because without you, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have been able to ride. And so it's been a pleasure to know you, and thank you very much for all of your help.
Well, I disagree with that. You would have made it no matter what, because you're an incredibly determined young lady. But I was saddened to find out that she was going to have to move on to another career. But I'm so glad that she landed here.
Yeah,
because
lucky
she's very articulate. And I loved the describing of the race when she sort of orated or dictated the Preakness.
Oh,
run.
Yeah. Yeah,
when she did that last spring, it was fantastic, and the way she articulated what a jockey goes through, what's going through the jockey's mind after the gates open up, and you're visualizing all the stuff that's going on up in front of you, how you use anticipation to make certain decisions, I was blown away. I was so impressed.
Wow. Yeah, it was. She did an unbelievable job with that, and it's great to have her as my broadcast partner here on Jock Talk every Tuesday night, 6 to 7 Eastern. Of course, you can listen worldwide at horseracingradio.net and via podcast on our website. That podcast available for you shortly after we finish up here at 7 o'clock Eastern time. First of all, what kind of student was she, Chris? You talked about how proud you are, but what kind of student was she?
Always early and never left the barn until she asked, is everything done?
Really?
And in the classroom, when it came to lectures and stuff like that, straight A's. I mean, she was very attentive. Her brain is a sponge. She loves to learn. And I'm glad that she's learning this part of the business, this part of the racing business, which is trying to promote our game as best she possibly can. And Mike, you selected a very good subject for that.
Well, selected a good subject for this. And of course, for the program here tonight, as I mentioned, Hall of Famer Chris McCarron with us. And when you look back on the career of Chris McCarron, he grew up in Dorchester, Massachusetts, which is in Boston. He was inducted into Racing's Hall of Fame in 1989, retired from riding in 2002, having ridden more than 34,000 races and winning 7,141 of those. Among those victories are 6 Triple Crown races and 9 winning rides in the Breeders' Cup. And again, couldn't be happier to have him with us here on Jock Talk tonight. And Chris, thinking back on those numbers and your entire career, could you ever imagine when you first started walking HOTS as a young man that it would end up here?
No, I couldn't imagine that, Mike. I followed my brother Greg into the sport. Greg started riding races in 1969 at Suffolk Downs when I was a freshman in high school. And I would get out of school about 2:45 in the afternoon, jump on the train, go two stops from the north end of Boston, where I went to Christopher Columbus High School, go two stops to East Boston. Actually, Suffolk Downs has a train station right behind the track. And I would go from track to track, if you will,
wow,
the train track to the racetrack. And at that time, they didn't let anyone into the races under 18 years of age. And I was 13 or 14, I think. And at the time, I was 14. And I would climb the fence to watch him ride the last three or four races. And I got so excited about, you know, he would yell to me, he'd be galloping out, "Christina, you'll get a kick out of this." I would stand at the 7/8 pole. You know, I didn't want to get too close to the grandstand because I'd get booted out.
Sure.
So I basically watched the race from a distance, and then he would, as he was galloping out, I would yell to him, and then he'd turn around. When he pulled up and turned around, he'd come back and say, "Get back to school." I'd say, "School's out." So those are such great memories.
So you were always a fan of horse racing in some aspect?
Not until Greg started riding.
Okay.
You know, so none of us knew anything about the racetrack growing up. As a matter of fact, when Greg was, the way he got introduced was he was attending his first semester of college at Bentley College in Waltham, Massachusetts, and he was working at a department store called Jod and Mosh and pushing boxes around. So, and this lady who was a cashier at the time was making fun of him, saying, "You're too small to be lifting and pushing these boxes. You need to be out there making money as a jockey," you know?
Yep.
And she knew the general manager at Suffolk Downs at the time, Tom Beatham. And so she scheduled an interview with Tom Beatham, and then Tom introduced Odie to a guy named Junie Bresnahan. And Junie was a very famous trainer who also brought out race riders. And at the time, Junie's barn was full. He had three kids that were learning how to be jockeys. So Junie sent him over to Odie Cleland's barn, and that was certainly a wonderful place to land because Odie was incredibly honest and hardworking, and, you know, he was like our second dad.
Yeah.
And so Greg went on to learn the ropes from Odie, but he came home one day late in the afternoon, and at the dinner table, he said, "Mom, Dad," he said, "I think I'm going to quit school and get a job at the racetrack."
How'd that go over?
And my mom slams her fork down and she says, "Over my dead body. No son of mine's going to be involved with a bunch of derelicts, degenerates, and gamblers. It's not going to happen." And he says, "Well, I quit about a month ago, and I've been walking horses at Suffolk Downs for the last month." And so that was 1967. And 2 years later, he started riding races. But he'd only been on the job about a month or two at the most, and he got kicked in the face. But thank God it was a two-year-old that didn't have hind shoes on. Oof. Otherwise, it would have created a lot more damage to his face. But he broke the orbital bone, and he actually still to this day has a metal plate inside his skull that holds his eye in place. And so he spent about a month in the hospital back in 1967. And my mom was relieved, thinking, okay, well, thank God he's alive. And this will get that horse stuff out of his system. Because he got hurt, he's not going to want to go back and get a job. But nothing was further from the truth.
Yeah.
So he went back to work, and that's one of the reasons why I had so much trepidation when I first started working on the track. I graduated from high school in 1972, and the day after I was out of school, I was on the track, and it took me about, I've shared this with my students, it took me about 8 or 9 months to get comfortable working around the thoroughbreds because I always thought, I got to be careful not to get kicked, don't get stepped on, don't get bitten.
Right.
And all of those things happen. But I tell my students, especially the newcomers, if you get stepped on, if you get bitten, or if you get kicked, it's your fault. It's not the horse's fault because you were in the wrong place.
Yep.
And not necessarily at the wrong time, but just in the wrong place. You have to be careful working around thoroughbreds. So it was a kind of a roundabout way to get introduced to the horses and racing. But thank goodness. I certainly believe in fate.
Yeah.
And Chris, I read an article that said that your brother Greg told your mother that she had nothing to worry about, that you would never make it. Is that true?
That's exactly right. It has to do with that fear. Greg got me a job as a hot walker at Rockingham Park between my junior and senior year in high school. That was 1971. So I walked horses for about 2.5 months up in Salem, New Hampshire. And I had about 5 days, 6 days left on the job. And Odie, our boss, said, Chris, I want you to go put a helmet on. And Dwayne's going to bring this filly out. It was a 2-year-old filly who was owned by Peter Fuller, who was famous for owning Dancer's Image, who won the 1968 Kentucky Derby, only to be disqualified because of a drug violation. Yeah. But my boss, Odie, trained a lot of horses for Peter Fuller, and he was a very successful owner and breeder in New England for many years. And so this filly's name was You Picked a Beauty. And she was a beauty. She was pretty, but she was also as kind as could be. She was like a pony. And I had been riding the pony all summer long. Odie liked to cool horses out from horseback, and so he wanted me to get as much saddle time as possible. So I would ride the pony around the barn while I'm cooling horses out and watering them off and putting them back, you know, I'd give them back to the groom and put them in the stall. So it came time to get a leg up on this filly. And when my butt hit the saddle, I just froze. And Odie saw this incredibly fearful look in my face. And he just said, get off her, boy, get off her. And when he said that, I thought she was going to do something bad.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to slide off, but I was frozen. Finally, he just reached up and pulled me off. And Greg was there. So he went to the payphone in the barn and he called home and said, Mom, Dad, he said, don't worry. Chris is scared to death. He's never going to make it. So you're not going to have to worry about, you know, fretting over his livelihood as a jockey.
Yeah. Didn't he go on to say it was the only time he's been wrong? But he was definitely wrong about that one.
He was definitely wrong.
You mentioned your brother being kicked by that 2-year-old and yet still coming back and getting back in the saddle and continuing to ride races. And by the way, your brother, people may not realize, won more than 2,400 races in his career. So he could certainly ride. I'm always curious. I know you've had your fair share of injuries over your career, as most jockeys do. What is it that makes a jockey want to get back in that saddle after something like that?
I'm going to let Christina answer that first. I'm going to impose.
Yeah. What is it, Christina?
Because she got hurt a bunch too in a very short span of time. I mean, yeah. She broke her neck and, you know, she walks in my barn one day with a neck brace on just shortly after she got injured up.
She,
was it Laura?
She told me she doesn't remember that.
Well, I don't remember the actual spill, but I remember walking in your barn.
Yeah.
But, I would
what
say.
What is it that makes us, you know, say, okay, we get through the stage of the pain, the discomfort, the recovery, mm-hmm. the rehab, mm-hmm. and all the hard work that we have to put into getting fit again. Why do we do that?
It's hard to explain, really. I mean, we're all maybe a little bit crazy, but you know, I still think about, I rode my last race in March and I still think it's still there. You know, I still want to get back on a horse, but, I guess it's our passion. That's what we love to do. And so no matter what, we're going to do it. And I know when I was hurt, the first question I would ask the doctor was, when can I get back on the horse?
Yeah.
It's the exhilaration.
Yeah, well, it's like
Mike,
any athlete.
It's the exhilaration that we feel, the excitement, that feeling of not just accomplishment, but exhilaration is the best noun I can think of that we experience when, and then after the fact. I mean, the exhilaration comes from you're going along, you know you've got some horse, you're pretty sure you've got some horse underneath you, and you get to a point where you go like that, and you first chirp, first ask him to run, you throw across, you go ahead and shake the stick at him a little bit, and every time you feel another surge, you feel another acceleration. Now you feel the horse lengthening his stride. The feeling is unbelievably exciting. And then you get to the wire first. So then you're galloping back after the race, and you're thinking about everything that just happened. Okay, so I made a decision at the half-mile pole. I put Lafitte in a little bit of a spot. I made a move that caused Shoe to steady a little bit. I might have been on the third best horse, but I just outrode these two guys who are the greatest riders of all time. That's what I strove for. That's what I was looking for every time I had to make a comeback. I wanted to get back out there and prove to you, prove to Christina, prove to Stick over here, prove to everybody that's out there watching that I'm as good, if not better. That's what drove me. The excitement of getting to the finish line first in any kind of race. It didn't matter if it was a $2,500 claimer when I was riding in Maryland, or if it was a, you know, a $2 million grade one on Breeders' Cup Day.
Right.
The excitement that you experience after achieving the very difficult task of getting a horse to perform at its best is something that I thirst for. I hungered for.
All right. Now, I know most riders have told me when I've had the same conversation with them that you can't ride scared. And the minute you have that enter your mind that you might get injured, you're done. You have no chance. How do you put that out of your mind when you're making that comeback? You put all the hard work in, you get yourself physically fit to come back after a major injury. Mentally, how do you get over that hurdle?
It's very challenging. There's no question about it. There's very challenging, especially when you get longer in the tooth. When you get north of 40 years of age, the difficulties that we face mentally become greater. They become more challenging. I thought when it came time for me to decide to retire, I'd wake up one morning and say, I'm not going to put those white pants on today. I'm just not going to go to work. I'm going to call the stewards and say, I'm not sick, Judge, but I'm off for good. And it didn't happen that way. It didn't happen. I couldn't tear myself away that quickly. You know, I had to stew over it. I had to dwell on it. And I did that probably for several months. And that's not doing anybody any justice. I'm not doing you as a handicapper, as a bettor, as an owner, as a breeder, as a trainer, as a groom, as an exercise rider, who they make more money when they win. I'm not doing anybody justice, including myself, by going out there and thinking that I hope it doesn't happen today. I did struggle with that for a while, and I finally just said, you know what, it's time to quit. And when I told Judy that I was going to hang it up, I told her that I had plans to go to Lone Star Park on a Friday night for an all-star race. And I told Judy I was going to announce it when the night was over. I was going to say, okay, I'm going to ride one more day, and that's tomorrow at Hollywood Park. And she talked me out of that. She said, you can't do that. They need time to plan. They they're going to want to give you a nice send-off, which they did. It was fantastic. So I announced it the next day at Hollywood Park, and the following Saturday, they provided me and my family with a wonderful, you know, send off, and it was something that I'll always treasure. But it's not easy to just walk away. It's not. But then again, it's the right thing to do, because you're right. You said it. If you're thinking about the dangers of what we do, your heart is not in it. You can't be completely focused on the job at hand, which is to get the most out of your horse. If you're thinking about it's you're too easily distracted.
Talking with Hall of Famer Chris McCarron here on Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Chris, and it's been quite the career, and I just want to bring up quickly, I read an article, and for me, when I rode, the weight and the getting fit but not being too strong, not having too much muscle, because muscle is heavier. So I read an article, a Pennsylvania jockey, Clinton Potts, he was quoted as saying, it's really as close as torching yourself as you can get, which is maybe close to the truth. But let me ask you, how tough was it for you? What was your daily regimen as far as what did you eat? How much did you work out? And when you were riding every day, the card, what was your schedule there?
Well, it's funny. My difficulties with my weight was not that bad early on in my career. I was pretty light. I weighed about 104 when I had the bug. And throughout most of my time in California, I weighed about 111, 112 pounds. But I had to watch it. I had to, the first thing you think about, Mike, when you go to a restaurant, you open the menu, and first thing that flashes through my mind is my memory of the overnight. For those out there, the overnight is the sheet of entries for the next day or two. So I'm thinking, okay, what's the lightest I have to do tomorrow? And from that, I'm going to determine what I'm going to have for dinner that night, whether it's going to be pasta or, you know, something a lot lighter than that.
Yeah.
So we don't only have to watch the caloric intake. We also have to concentrate on and think heavily about what does that particular meal weigh physically. You know, if you have some salad with grilled chicken on top of it, with a little bit of light dressing, that's probably only going to weigh about a pound. But if you have a steak with potatoes, you know, that's going to weigh like 3 pounds.
Sure.
Physically, you're going to be 3 pounds heavier automatically. So those are the things that you have to consider. And as far as working out, you asked me how much I work out. Mostly I worked out by getting on horses in the morning. Throughout my career, I was a stickler for getting out to the barns every day, you know, if not 7 days a week, certainly 6 days a week. And I would breeze a lot of horses in the morning. As a matter of fact, Mike Smith, your wonderful guest you had last week, he used to tease me. He said, God, come on, CJ, give us a break, man. You're making it hard on the rest of us. We have to come out here every single day now. You know, he said, we didn't have it like this in New York. It wasn't that hard for us in New York, you know, before Mike moved to California. But when I moved out to California, the first agent I had made it a point that I got to show my face as to as many barns as I possibly can during the span of the morning workouts. And I got to a point where, and I've shown Christina my books, I used to keep this little calendar book. I saved about 6 of them, and I would write down my schedules. I would write down the horse's name, how well the horse breezed, the time it went. I would put a star, a little plus sign, if the horse breezed well. I would put a star beside it if it was something that I definitely wanted to ride.
Yep.
And so I would share this information with my agent, and I was pretty organized as far as that goes. And the thing about it was, for the longest time, I kept that a secret. So if I worked a really nice filly for Charlie Whittingham, and Charlie had a schedule, he would breeze horses every 5 days. McAnally was every 6 days. Vanberg was every 6 days. So I knew their scheduling. And so if I breezed a nice filly, a maiden for Charlie Whittingham, what I really liked, I want to make sure I breeze her next week. Well, in 4 days' time, I'd go back to Charlie's barn and say, is that filly scheduled to breeze tomorrow? And he would say, how do you know? And I said, well, I know I breezed her 4 days ago. And, you know, so that would impress them that way, that I'm that much on top of my game, you know. But I know I kind of got off topic here with regard to your question.
Yeah, you talk about the fitness aspect.
I didn't start working out until later in my career.
Yeah.
When I got to the point where I was riding fewer horses in the afternoon, I was still getting on horses in the morning, but in order to maintain that real peak fitness to be able to compete in the afternoon, I started going to the gym. And I'd go to the gym about 5 days a week.
Yeah, Mike Smith told us that he had a rigorous exercise regimen that he still follows to this day. But I don't know if there was anybody more strict about their diet and their workout program than Lafitte Pincai Jr.
He's amazing.
It absolutely incredible. And you mentioned Lafitte and Shoemaker, two best riders of all time.
Yeah, and polar opposites. She weighed 90 pounds soaking wet and could eat anything he wanted, but he kept himself on a very nutritious diet, not for the weight maintenance of it, but for his energy level. You know, he never ate salt. He was very strict about, he wasn't so strict about, you know, when it came time to party, because he would love to, you know, he was such a fun guy. I mean, he just incredibly bright and you know, articulate, and I learned so much from him, both him and Lafitte, that it was just I feel so blessed to have been able to ride with those guys for so many years.
For sure. And is it right, I think, Chris, you're third in highest earnings?
Yeah
behind Pat Day and Jerry Bailey, I believe.
Correct. Yes.
Well, and Johnny just, right, didn't he just surpass everybody this year? Isn't he like 300 million or something like that now?
I don't know.
I want to say Johnny went straight to the head of the class this year.
That I'm not sure. He could have, but I know Todd passed Wayne, right?
Yeah.
I believe Todd
passed Wayne, which would go hand in hand with Johnny, I guess, since he was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, when I was.
I think you might be back to fourth now, Jock.
It could be, but there's one thing that they cannot take away from me. when I retired, I was number one.
There you go.
That's right. How much did that mean to you to be number one when you stepped away?
Well, I jokingly, it meant a lot. You know, it's certainly a large feather in my cap. But I joke about it all the time, saying that Pat Day was catching me, you know. and I figured, well, by the time, you know, if he keeps winning races at his pace and I keep winning at my pace, it's probably going to be less than 6 months before he passes me. So I want to take advantage of the opportunity and say, I retired on top. So I retired in June 23rd of 2002, and in August of that year, he won a grade one, I think it was, on a horse called With Anticipation.
Yep.
For Jonathan Shepherd. And he surpassed my record at that time.
And by the way, a lot of people will forget, you went out on top with that winning ride and came home in the Affirmed Handicap.
I did, yes. That was a lot of fun. And I talked to my brother Greg for about an hour on the phone when it came time for me to reach out and talk to somebody about the possibility of my stepping away, you know, hanging up the boots and saddle and everything. So I talked to Greg for about an hour, and at the end of the conversation, he said, do it. He said, everything I've heard, he said, you're ready. He said, just move on, find something else to do. And he said, same thing I talked about earlier, which is where I learned it. You're not doing anybody justice by going out there and riding half-assed. You can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Didn't Greg surprise you?
Yeah.
In the ceremony?
I asked him to come on out, and he said, no, Darlene and I, his wife, we have too many horses at the farm we have to take care of. We can't take the weekend off, you know, and we can't find anybody that's going to help us out. And I said, oh, come on, just let Darlene do it. You come out, you know, or send her out and you do it, or whatever. But one of you needs to be here. No, I'm sorry, we can't do it. So halfway through the ceremony, Mike Willman made mention of the fact that I tried to get Greg to come on out. And sure enough, he was standing behind me. So when Mike said, go ahead and turn around and see who's here, I just broke down and started crying. Yeah, it was great. Yeah, he was my mentor for a long time, and very, very smart race rider. You know, as you said, he won over 2,500 races, and a very good race rider.
We'll continue our visit with Hall of Famer Chris McCarron here on Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Step away for a quick break. We're back with more. Stay with us here on HRN.
This is the Horse Racing Radio Network, your home for racing's biggest events.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Pena, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word JOCKEY to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word JOCKEY to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
If it happens in horse racing, it happens on HRRN.
But California Chrome shines bright in the Kentucky Derby! What a memorable Breeders' Cup Classic! It's a race for the ages! Here's the wire, and it's a photo finish that goes to Tonelin! Wise Dan gets his head in front! The first $1 million race in Keeneland history!
Racing's biggest events are right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.
And we're going to kick things off with trainer Graham Motion, Hall of Fame trainer Bill Mott here on Trainer Talk. Roger Apfield is going to be with us for the next half an hour. Carl Nasker, an honor to have him on the show tonight. Hall of Fame trainer Shug McGahey, nice enough to spend some time with us. I want to welcome Hall of Famer Bob Baffert to the program.
Trainer Talk, the biggest names in horse racing. Wednesdays, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern on Sirius 220 and XM 206. And always streaming live at horseracingradio.net.
Hi, this is Joel Rosario, and I listen to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And the field turns for home. Here comes the art winner, Saki, and he storms to the lead. Saki, a narrow lead, and Tesnell is battling on the American Horse of the Year. And the art winner, our heads up on the Baron Nadal Classic. On the outside, Saki, Tesnell fights on. Here's the winner, desperately close. Tesnell wins it for America, beating Saki.
Welcome back to Jock Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Christina McManigal in our Lexington, Kentucky studios with Hall of Famer Chris McCarron. And boy, you hear that race call, and Tisnow wins it for America. Tom Durkin at his very best. And that was the 2001 Breeders' Cup Classic. It was the first of two consecutive Breeders' Cup victories for Tisnow. And Chris, of course, one of those more memorable moments in your career.
Certainly, without question, nobody, myself included, or Jay Robbins, his trainer, knew which Tisnow was going to show up that day, because a week prior to that race, I was scheduled to work him at Santa Anita Park, and he was being a little obstreperous that day. Didn't want to go. He was sulking, and most people just kind of wrote him off because they thought there was something physically wrong with him at best, and mentally wrong with him at worst. And so it was well documented. The TV cameras were out there, and it literally took me 40 to 45 minutes to encourage him to go ahead and breeze. And when he finally did, he worked a mile. Christina, you'll appreciate this, because most horses start gearing it down, shutting it down when they pass the finish line. Mm-hmm. But I breezed him from the half-mile pole all the way around back to the half-mile pole. He worked in 36-2, which is race time in most places.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so that to me signaled his readiness, signaled his soundness. And but I just didn't know at the time which horse was going to show up on the day to run. And fortunately, the Tisnow we all know and love did show up that day.
Well, fortunately for you, and fortunately for the New England Patriots that year as well.
Yeah, the Patriots got off to a poor start that year. They lost like four or five of their first four or five games, and when Coach Belichick got to see the Breeders' Cup Classic at Belmont and Tisnow showed the resiliency, that the determination and the sheer fight to get to the wire first after having been passed by Saki on the outside, the best horse from Europe, and he decided to show the stretch run of that race to his players to get them out of this funk, get them out of this, you know, the slump that they were in. And they went on, and they never lost another game, and they won the Super Bowl that year.
Wow.
And I was lucky enough to be able to sign a bunch of baseball caps, which said, "Tisnow to the Patriot and all of us." I signed one to Coach Belichick, to Tom Brady, and the rest of the teammates and so forth, and that was a lot of fun.
It worked.
Yeah, it worked.
Very cool. And Chris, I have another question, kind of not related to this, but I attended your jockey school, as we all know, and up until you opened the school in 2006, there was no school in the United States. There were schools in Europe and Canada, but there was no school in the United States. And tell me, how did that come to be? How did you come up with that idea to open the school?
Well, in 1998, I was invited to Tokyo to compete in an all-star race with Bill Shoemaker. We both represented the United States at the time. And I went there the weekend ahead of time to ride a horse called Pay the Butler for Bobby Frankel. And we got lucky and won the Japan Cup that Sunday. And the all-star weekend was the following Saturday and Sunday. There were two races on Saturday and two on Sunday. And on the Wednesday in between those two weekends, I was invited to speak in front of the Japan Racing Association Jockey School. And I came away from that experience incredibly impressed. They were not just teaching these young men how to work around thoroughbreds, but it was a full-blown academic program as well. They were teaching them math, science, language, history, and so forth. and they were receiving some very important school credits for their work. And that basically just planted a seed. 2 years later, on the day I was to ride Sunday Silence in his first start as a four-year-old, I was involved in a spill, and I broke my left femur, my right fibula, and my right ulna. And as I'm laying in the hospital at, right down the street from Hollywood Park, I was thinking, if this was the type of injury that would end my career, what would I want to do next? And I determined that it would either be train horses or train kids how to ride. And, you know, I'm always one that looks for a challenge, and we all know that training horses is easy. Just ask Jude Feld.
Sure. Piece of cake.
Piece of cake.
No problem.
No problem. Never any headaches or anything. You know, everything goes smooth sailing. Mm-hmm. So I wanted the real challenge of training people. So I decided to, when I retired from riding in 2002, I had my sights set on opening a school. I got sidetracked a couple of times because I worked on the feature film Seabiscuit, as you know, mm-hmm. for about 8 months. And then I worked at Santa Anita in management there for about a year and a half. And then once I relieved myself of those duties, if you will, I decided to go ahead and move to Kentucky. And the reason I did that was because I thought, being the horse capital of the world, it was probably create greater opportunities for me to garner the type of governmental support a school of this kind would need. And I'm glad I made that decision, because the Kentucky Community and Technical College system has been incredibly supportive financially, emotionally, academically, you name it. And they're the main reason why the school was able to get off the ground.
Well, I'm very glad that all worked out. Very yes. glad.
It's good for
so
you.
It's very good for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's been the most rewarding part of teaching young riders, Chris?
I hope this doesn't sound corny or funny, but a lot of our kids have gotten degrees. I've gotten associate's degrees in applied equine science. On top of that, obviously, I derive a great deal of pleasure and feel a sense of pride when I do my occasional recaps, not recaps, but updates, the statistical updates. Our grads have won close to 2,700 races.
Wow.
And they've earned in excess of $35 million in purses. So I'm very pleased that the individuals who came to the program in a very committed way, stayed committed, and then went out there to ply their trade and ply what they've learned and extend that educational process by riding on a daily basis in a very competitive environment, very competitive sport, that does my heart good.
How would you describe your teaching philosophy?
Number one is work ethic. That is number one. The great coach John Wooden, in his book, there was one sentence that one quote that he has. He said, "I'll take an eager mediocre player over a willing star any day of the week." And he can turn what he was looking for was eagerness. The biggest difference between eagerness and willingness is Christina McManigal. She shows up in the barn in the morning and says, "What can I do? What is there to do?" You know, the willing person will wait for an instruction and go ahead and execute it, you know. But the people, the students that have gone on to do really well out of our program fit that mold of eagerness. They didn't come there a lot of times. For instance, our leading rider, Ben Creed, who I love dearly, when he was in our program for first year, he was lazy as all get out. He was Christina's roommate. Classmate, you know. And, you know, where's Ben? Oh, he's outside smoking. Put that cigarette down, Ben. Come on, get back in here and muck this stall. Come on, take care of this horse. Pick his feet out, you know. He transformed himself. He became so enthralled with the excitement of breezing a nice horse. Christina will tell you, my horses at our school can't outrun a fat man, yeah. you know. But when you get Ben, I sent him to Southern California to John Sadler. He worked for John for about 4 months at Hollywood Park. Ben went from exercising two horses a day at NARA to riding 10, 12 a day for John, and horses can run, you know.
Yeah.
So that really set the hook in his mouth. you know, big time. And so he came back from that experience a much better rider, much more polished rider. And he demonstrated everything that he learned. He went out there to, he's won over 500 races.
I can't imagine what it must be like being a student and a young person that wants to get into riding races. And Christina, you can speak to this and be able to learn from somebody like Chris McCarron.
Oh, it's incredible. And he's there every day. It's not just the name. It's his school. He was there every day, and we get on the Equisizer and, you know, race who can last the longest. You know, Mike, how that is.
90 seconds. I made it 90 seconds in the Chris McCarron Challenge. Yeah.
The only, you know, I wish that if I could turn the clock back, I wish that I was more involved with actually going out there and breezing in company with them and talking to them as we're going through the exercise, you know. I'm not exactly sure how I dropped that ball, but one thing I would do is if a student was having a lot of difficulty with a horse, whether it be out in the field or the training track, I would get up on the horse, and this was not meant to embarrass anybody. This was just to demonstrate that this can be done if you just listen to my instruction and try to incorporate the technique that I'm trying to teach you with my hands, with my balance, and with my rhythm. I'm going to demonstrate to you that I can do it with one hand. And Christina saw me do it countless times, and, you know, the student would get all red in the face. No, no, Katie, I'm not trying to embarrass you. You know, this horse just ran off with you, and I'm going to get up on him now, and I'm going to put my hands in such a place that he's not going to run off from me. I'm going to be able to, I would go out there and do figure eights in the big field that we use just with one hand. And then things would start to click with them. They go, okay, I'm not exactly doing what you're telling me to do. Therefore, I'm going to have to tweak something. I'm going to have to figure out exactly what I'm doing wrong with my hands so I can do it exactly how you're doing it. The second part of the philosophy I teach, other than work ethic, is my number one goal when I'm on a horse, whether, don't even have to be on a horse, in the horse's stall, I'm leading a horse in the shed row, is cooperation. I want to get this horse to cooperate better for me than he would for Christina, than he would for Mike Penna, than he would for Stick over here, than he would for any other rider or any other person. My goal is to try to get into that horse's head, try to figure out what makes it tick, and then get the most out of that horse. And I get the most out of a horse by gaining cooperation, whether that's rating, you know, getting a horse to come back to me, which means I'm getting the horse to ration its speed. I'm getting a horse to be aggressive in a race. I'm getting a horse to be quiet in the gate. Whatever the immediate task at hand is, my goal is cooperation.
Hall of Fame jockey Chris McCarron on Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Chris, let's turn the clock back to one of your first milestones as a rider, and that was in 1974 when you were the leading apprentice, set all kinds of records that day, just obliterated the previous records. You told me in the commercial break that you just celebrated an anniversary for that milestone.
Yeah, on December 17th of 1974, I walked into the winner's circle for the 516th time. The record was set the year before by Sandy Hawley, who's a very good friend of mine. Bill Shoemaker's record of 485 stood for 25 years, and Sandy came along in 1973 and broke Shoe's record of 485. He won 486 that day. I happened to be at the track on that day, and I was an exercise rider at the time, and I was trying to crash the party, trying to squeeze into the winner's circle, try to get in the photograph, but it didn't work out. Sandy went on to win 515 races that year in 1973. And I came along in 1974. I rode my first race on January 24th. I broke my maiden on my 10th mount, which was February 9th of 74. And by the end of March, I had about, a month and a half after I started riding, I had about 20, 25 winners under my belt. So I was on my way. And then from April 1st to December 31st, I won another 520-something races. And as we know, the apprenticeship lasts typically 1 year. It's typically the anniversary of the date of your fifth winner.
Okay.
Is when your apprenticeship allowance will end. Okay. So I'm going to brag a little bit. Okay.
You're allowed.
If I haven't done so already. But I won over 600 races with the Bug. From I forget the date of my fifth winner. My first winner was February 9th. My fifth winner was probably about February 20th or something like that. So from February 20th of 74 to February 20th of 75. I won about 610 races.
Now, after you did that, was it instantaneous that everybody wanted to ride Chris McCarron because of how hot you were at that point?
I was so fortunate. There were four very, very talented riders plying their trade in Maryland when I started riding that left. Vincent Bruschelli, a.k.a. Jimbo, was a very, very talented rider, leading rider all the time. He signed a contract to go to New York for Greentree. Eric Walsh was riding everything for King Leatherberry. So Jimbo was riding everything for John Tamaro Sr. and Dickie Dutrow.
Mm-hmm.
Sandy Hawley was riding a lot for Dickie Dutrow as well. He left in the end of February and went to Hot Springs, Arkansas, as did Daryl McCarg, another very, very talented rider. Daryl was riding everything for the Lassiter stable at the time, and Lawrence was a trainer. And so those four outfits were in need of riders that they could get. And I was fortunate enough to be selected many, many times, and I won a ton of races for those guys. And so I was certainly in the right place at the right time. Eric Walsh didn't leave Maryland. He actually, funny story, he got very angry at a fellow rider by the name of Luigi Gino. And Gino had shut Eric off, and Eric was very upset after the race, and he walked back into the jocks room at Pimlico and was going to take a swing at Luigi, but since he was his friend, he didn't really want to punch him, and he punched the door, and he broke his fist.
Oh, no.
He broke three bones in his hand, which opened up Leatherberry's stable and gave me tremendous opportunity to ride for some very, very serious and powerful outfits, and Bud Delp was another trainer who put me on a lot of winners when I had the Bug.
I read, Chris, I've read that you've ridden in 22 states and 7 countries. What other countries have you ridden in other than Japan, as you mentioned?
England, Canada, Australia. I never rode France. I never rode in Ireland. Brazil. I rode in Brazil way back in 1975.
Wow.
I think that's about it.
Yeah.
I didn't do as much traveling as some of the other very well-known riders, like Gary Stevens, who's been all over the place, Hong Kong and Singapore. And I'm not begrudging anything. I'm very fortunate. I feel very blessed to have been given so many opportunities. And you just touched on something. Going back to my parents, how opposed they were to Greg and me getting a job at the racetrack and becoming jockeys. Needless to say, before they passed away, they were very, very proud of the accomplishments, and they had the opportunity to get to see us ride in front of the Queen of England, or Dubai is another place that I've ridden many times. Get to ride in front of the royal family of Dubai and stuff like that. So they were very satisfied with the decisions that Greg and I made.
We'd be able to spend 2 hours talking about the champions that you've been aboard and the classic races you won. I mentioned all the Triple Crown races, but if Chris McCarron is putting together his own personal resume tape or highlight tape of your career, what are the couple of moments that you're going to make sure are front and center on that tape?
I think the first race that I would like to have people watch, and unfortunately, I don't have access to, that would be my 516th winner. That, as I stated earlier, it happened on December 17th, 1974. My dad had flown down from Boston a few days prior to that. And it's funny, it happens a lot, not just with jockeys, but a lot of different athletes. They seem like they get to the threshold of a milestone, and it takes several games, or it takes several days, or it might take a week to cross over that threshold and finally get that winner. I have no idea what causes that. It's probably got to be something to do with mental attitude or whatever, maybe pressing or trying too hard. But as I stated, my dad was there, and he had flown down from Boston, and he was there for 3 days because I didn't win any races the first day he got there or the next day. So finally on the third day, I was coming down the stretch head in head with my brother Greg, and he was on a horse called Boston Ego.
Wow.
And the race was 7 furlongs, and I was on a horse called Oh My Love for Dickie Dutrow. And we virtually went head in head from the eighth, from the gate to the wire, going 7/8. And I hung on one by a head. And I posted this photograph on Facebook last week celebrating my anniversary. And I said, unfortunately, you cannot see. My brother Greg's in the picture, but you can't see him because I was on the outside and you couldn't see Oh My Love. I mean, you couldn't see Boston Eagle or Greg on the inside because we covered him up. But that would be the number one. And then I think the Hall of Fame induction ceremony would be the next clip. That's without question the achievement I'm most proud of because it's a culmination of a lot of years of hard work and success. Any one given race, like the Derby or any Triple Crown race or a Breeders' Cup race, is wonderful to win, no question. But it's a question of being in the right place at the right time, whereas the Hall of Fame is recognition of a lot of hard work and dedication to your trade.
How'd you find out that you were in the Hall of Fame?
You know, I don't recall.
It wasn't a phone call or a...
Yeah, it was a phone call. I don't recall who it was that picked up the phone and called. I knew, I want to say I knew in March of that year that I was nominated for it. And it was my first year of eligibility. In order to be eligible for a rider, you have, at that time, you had had ridden for 15 years. I think they moved it to 20 now. But I think they do also have some ability to move that around a little bit, because I'd like to think if I had the same career up to the point that I did and only rode 14 years, I think, you know, the decision would have been the same. But that's, and then of course the Derby would be next.
Yeah.
You know, the Derby is our big kahuna.
Which one? There were two. Both of them?
The first one's the most important. Yeah. I don't want to take anything away from Gopher Gin, because he certainly ran the best race of his life and his career that day. But Ali Sheba getting the first one for us was certainly, I think, more important, because up until that time, all the traveling I did, I'd be sitting on a plane or sitting in an airport and someone would recognize that I've got a tack bag. They'd see my riding crop.
Yeah.
Oh, what is that? Oh, are you a jockey? Yeah, I'm a jockey. Oh, really? Have you ever ridden in the Kentucky Derby? Yes, I have. Have you ever won it? Up until 1987, all I could say was, no, I finished second a couple times. Invariably, the conversation would pretty much cease, but when they discover that they're sitting beside a Kentucky Derby winner, the conversation goes on for the length of the flight, which is always fun.
Christina, you were telling me earlier that there were a couple of people who sent you notes wanting to know things about Chris McCarron when they found out he was going to be joining us on Jock Talk here tonight. And I know, Chris, you've done several
other
things outside of racing.
Here comes the Twitter. Here comes the Twitter account.
Yeah, this is not going to be good.
All right, Chris, I have one question here. Someone sent that you were a guest on an appearance on Quincy in 1985. The episode was called When Luck Ran Out. Can you tell us about that?
I played a jockey. Of all things, I played a jockey named Tommy Canfield.
I bet you were good in that role.
I was a nervous wreck. Jack Klugman was a super nice guy, just a great guy. And as you know, he was the star of the show. And but he had the writers write a script that a horse was going to become victim of insurance fraud. And so this trainer slash owner decided to drug this horse, and you know, he died after the race and stuff like that to collect this huge insurance policy. And Dr. Quincy was the ME, the medical examiner, that discovered, you know, that the horse had been poisoned. So that was, we shot it at Pomona, Fairplex Park.
Yeah.
That was
it had to be an unbelievable experience though, to get to work with a guy like Jack Klugman.
Oh, absolutely. And I rode a nice horse for him called Jacqueline Klugman.
Yep.
Jacqueline Klugman was he was third in the Kentucky Derby behind Genuine Risk and a horse called Rumbo. And but I didn't ride him that day. Darryl McCarg rode him. And then I got the mount on him later in his three-year-old season. I got to win the Jamaica handicap on him at Belmont. And we beat Fappiano that day. It was he was a very, very nice horse. And Jack was a super nice guy.
Were you more comfortable behind the camera when the Seabiscuit movie came out?
Oh, yeah, much more comfortable. Well, yeah. Yes and no. The stuff those jockeys did, Mike, it was just unbelievable. Incredible. I mean, we hired all jockeys. We didn't have any exercise riders, okay? Every one of those guys had ridden races before. And the reason I suggested we hire those people is because they're experienced. They know how to listen to instruction, understand it, and execute it. But the camera trucks were doing 35, 40 miles an hour right alongside these horses every single take. And I never slept as well in my life as I did the night after the final day of shooting at Santa Anita.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I went home and I had a wonderful dinner and I was sleeping by about 7 o'clock that night. I don't think I woke up until 7 the next morning. I was relieved that no one got hurt. We didn't have one accident on the set. That was amazing.
Only about 4 minutes left here in this edition of Jock Talk with Hall of Famer Chris McCarron. I know, Christina, you had one other comment there that came in.
I do. Someone wants to know, Chris, about your ride on Sunday Silence in the 89 Breeders' Cup Classic. And what did you do to mentally prepare yourself and physically also for that wonderful ride?
Well, thank you for the question. What did I do to mentally prepare? The same thing that I did pretty much every big race day. Try to ride as many races as possible to stay busy. One thing I did not like to do was stay idle during a big race day like that because you start thinking a little bit too much. As long as you're busy and you're plying your trade, you're going out there and just staying busy and not being distracted by outside things. The media can really get in your way. You know, when the media sees that, let's say you ride the first and second, then you don't ride till the fifth. Well, they're going to contact you and see if they can get an interview with you between the third and the fourth, you know, right during that time. And it became, I always tried to accommodate the media, but sometimes it became a real serious distraction. One thing I think that racing affords its fans and the media more so than other sports, we're very accessible, and I think Mike will agree to that.
Very much so.
Where, you know, there's no other sport you're going to be able to go to the locker room and talk to a competitor, a participant, whether it's football, basketball. You don't have access to those people until well before the event and then well after the event. So, anyway, I'm that's...
I remember that race, too, that classic. And I was a huge easygoer fan. And so you broke my heart that day, much like you did with Holy Bull in the Kentucky Derby, by the way. Don't know why Chris McCarron was my favorite jockey of all time because he killed me every time. But just curious, did you outfox Pat Day in that classic?
Sunday Silence was a better horse running around the turns.
Yes.
Sunday Silence was a little bit more agile on a sharper turn on a mile track than easygoer was, as evidenced in the Preakness when P-Val rode him. When Pat Day... put the squeeze on Sunday Silence going into the far turn in the Preakness. Sunday Silence dropped back almost two lengths. Within a 16th of a mile, he was back up head and head with Easy Goer again because of his ability to run the turns. The same thing in the Breeders' Cup Classic at Gulfstream Park. I looked under my elbow at the half-mile pole and saw two chestnut legs. And I got, oh, God, he's here already. And so I chirped to Sunday Silence to make sure that he's going to get ready to listen to my next command, which is going to be asking him to run. And when I chirped to him, as he switched leads going into the turn, he opened up four on Easy Goer, wow, as you remember.
Yeah.
So when I turned for home, I'm four or five in front of him, and the race was won on the turn. And it wasn't because I outfoxed him, but Charlie did tell me, don't hit the colt. He didn't like to be hit with a stick. And I never hit him. I just waved the stick at him, and I just started screaming at the 16th pole, come on, wire! Come on, wire!
Chris McCarron, he found the wire more than 7,000 times in his career. Just unbelievable. Chris, I can't believe it's over. I want to keep going for another hour. You'll have to come back and join us for part two up the road. But thanks so much for taking the time to come in studio here on Jock Talk tonight.
Thanks very much for having me. Christina, thanks for the invitation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas, everybody out there in Christmas land. Yeah, Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year to everybody indeed. For our producer, Lee Delapina, for Christina McManigal, and for Chris McCarron, I'm Mike Penham. We'll talk to you next week on Jock Talk.